Good morning, everybody. I've had a good morning of practice. It occurred to me that you might want to ask some questions before I go into today's talk, just in case there was something in your group that you weren't satisfied with, or things from the talk yesterday that occurred to you. So if we could just have a little time, if you like, for some questions, and I'll try to answer them, or not. It's up to you. Yes.
It's a sort of very practical question, really. Where is the original source of this?
Where
do you find it?
Okay, where you find the text? There's two sources. The first of which, probably the cheapest source, is, well, the very you can actually find it on the internet, I think. If you tap in the Door of Liberation, you should be able to find it. But there is a book called The Door of Liberation by somebody called Geshe Wangyal, who was an old friend of Bantu's, died quite a long time ago, a Mongolian Lama. And it's a really wonderful collection of different texts from Tsongkhapa and the Gelug tradition, and these Kadampa precepts. It was published around 1973, 1974, but it's a great text, wonderful. There's another translation of it in a really big book called The Book of Kadam, which is a big collection of different Kadampa texts, translated by somebody named Tubten Jimpa. So those are the two sources. Yeah. But the Door of Liberation, going back to that text, you know, for some of us, Surita and myself and others, in the days when we were first coming along, there were very few good and reliable translations of Buddhist literature coming out. We'd just grab hold of, you know, whatever emerged and whatever Bantu was recommending and absolutely devour them, and they've become part, I think, of our own, you know, how can I put it, our own sort of map of the path, map of the Dharma. These days, one of the sad things is there's too much available. I was talking with Robin recently this morning about free Buddhist audio, and it's just too much. And that can mean, I think, that we don't get the precept of the Lama, relating it to what I was talking about yesterday, that there's just so much available, and, you know, in a sense, so much sort of marketing, this is the thing you really need to hear, and so on, that we skip around and we don't really go into anything very deeply. When we were youngsters first coming along, there wasn't a lot available. That meant we had to keep going over the same material again and again and yet again. Of course, Bantu's experience back in India, he had hardly any books. He didn't have the money for the books, and also he was a wanderer. But what he had, he really made use of, and would read and reread and reflect and meditate upon to make it into a living experience. And if we want the essential teaching, it's better to really strip down what we take in and go over again and again and yet again the same text. You can even turn, I think, sutras, the word of the Buddha, Bhante's writings even, they can become for you precepts. I've had this experience particularly on solitary retreat, where I'll be, usually what I do on solitary, I'll take a text like the Dhammapada or the root verses of the six bardos or the Bodhicaryavatara, and I'll keep reading it and rereading it out loud. And what will happen then in meditation is that a verse or even just a line or even half a line will just start hitting me and sort of teaching me, as if the Buddha is becoming my preceptor, as it were. Remember one particular solitary retreat where I was meditating on the root verses of the six bardos. There's a line in that which goes, entering into the reality undistractedly. And just that phrase became the precept for my retreat. Because my tendency is for my mind to go off here, there and everywhere. But this line just kept, as if Padmasambhava, who is, you know, said to be the origin of that text, was saying to me, this is what you had to do. And the reality was ordinary reality, not any kind of metaphysical reality, but just being fully in the present moment, attending what I needed to attend to. So this only works, I think, if you have quite a concentrated Dharma life where you're really focusing on just a few things. Yeah. Anyway, the Door of Liberation or the Book of Gadara.
You said there's no insight for oneself. Could you say a bit more about that? I'm thinking, well, whether there is a sense of there's insight, or there are possibly smaller insights where I might realise something which seems to affect.
Depends on sort of definitions, doesn't it? But I suppose what I think Bhante was getting at when he said that, and we'll be seeing more about this as we go on, that if any kind of realisation on whatever level, let's use the word realisation, the word insight seems to have got terribly loaded, quite unnecessarily so, but it's going to lead to, if it is an insight into impermanence or not self or dukkha or shunyata, you know, all these sort of classic ways of talking, that will mean that you're relinquishing, you're renouncing attachment, because the way we, you know, the way we fix ourselves is usually with craving and it's craving, aversion, fear, jealousy, etc. That's the way we, you know, there isn't a sort of an abstraction called the self or something like that. What we do is it's got this highly affective emotional sort of aspect to it. We attach to people and things. We're aversive to people and things. We're fearful of people and things. We're jealous about people and things. We're conceited about people and things, etc. So if you've seen through any kind of fixity, that means there's going to be, to the degree of that, there's going to be a relinquishing of those sorts of emotions. And to the contrary, there's going to be the emergence of their opposite. It's not going to be neutral. As this comes out very strongly in the next text we're going to do. It turns, for example, into love to some degree. So I think what Bhante was getting at was that, well, if it really is a seeing, it will result in that. You've seen through those things, or you've seen through a sense of separation from self and other. It's all a question of degree. It's all a question, perhaps, of depth of realization. But I think it is going to be very, very odd if somebody claims a realization and it's not leading to some sort of change, particularly in their relationships with other people. I think that is highly, highly questionable. You are getting sort of rather fancy explanations of why somebody might be quite negative after an insight. Oh, well, it's a spiritual death. They're falling apart. You're getting a big flushing up of the kleshas and things like that. Maybe for a very short period, but it wouldn't be expressed. It would be completely contained, and it wouldn't last for very long. And it would also suggest that the preparation isn't as it should be. The classic Buddhist tradition is that you cannot separate wisdom and love. You can't do that. And if you try to do that, I think you're in real trouble. Yeah. Wisdom and love. Yeah, wisdom and metta. You can't do that. You can't do that. Well, people do that, but that would go against the classic Buddhist tradition, I would say. Well, put it this way, if somebody comes up to me and they say, well, I can conclusively prove from this sutta that you can have insight without love and compassion, well, I'll just say I'm not interested, because I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. But I think I'm on very good grounds for saying that. Yeah. Is that helpful? Yeah. Well, you mean order members?
Well, order members, yeah. Giving the guidance and advice and support.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, for the main part, it's fairly consistent.
Yes.
In my situation, but, you know, occasionally it drifts from that, or sometimes you feel like there's sort of too many teachings, and I just wonder if you could kind of compare kind of the situation in the text to what we have.
Well, Bhante, you know that, do you remember the story of Mahaprajapati Gotami, his aunt, foster mother, who became his disciple? He tells a particular story about her, how can I tell whether any particular teaching is conducive to liberation? And the way Bhante tells it, you know, you've got all these different disciples and they all emphasize different things, and he does give her a criteria. I can't remember now, but Bhante is very, very fond, used to be very fond of quoting this particular teaching. He thinks it's very, very important. He's emphasizing experience, but it's definitely to do with, well, when you practice, is it leading to renunciation, to contentment, to metta, to, you know, increase of energy and all this sort of thing. So it's not that you're passive, this is very important, in relation to the teacher, the Kalyana Mitras, order members. There's your own native, is that the right word? Spiritual intelligence, dharmic intelligence, or emerging dharmic intelligence, and it's very, very important that you develop that, and that you, in the end, well, it's only you that can live the path, can practice the path. So you've really got to think, okay, well, he's saying one thing and he's saying another thing, but it's me that's living this dharma life. And actually, although I can see that's a good teaching that person said, it's not actually relevant to me right now. What this guy is saying is much more relevant, much more useful. You have the criteria that the Buddha gives is quite demanding, it has to be said, because we have, and it's definitely a criteria. It's not, well, it feels right, you know, because we might, you know, you can get it, don't you? You can go to someone, you know, spiritual friend, say, take it easy, you just need to take a rest more and all that sort of thing. And that's a very attractive sort of teaching, isn't it? Whereas another spiritual friend might say, actually, I think you need to make more effort. You know, if we're not careful, we end up choosing the rather soft path. Maitreya Vandu said a thing recently. He thought that sometimes some order members give the wrong kind of encouragement. They give the kind of encouragement where it's not encouraging people to make effort. It's more to do with, oh, you know, you need to relax, you need to do that, you know, you need to have a good time, you need to treat yourself. And he thought that was more to do with the order member feeling liked, wanting to feel liked, rather than what the person really needed, and so on. But in the end, you've got to make the distinction. It is down to you living a Dharma life, taking full responsibility for it. Might be what everybody is saying is wrong. You know, it's not actually any good. And I think also we need to be very careful with, especially for order members and aspiring order members, perhaps even about giving advice. I think that's you've got to be, you know, really careful in doing that. I know Bhante was always careful about it. What he would often do would be to throw you back on yourself. You know, really, he would ask sort of questions, or he would make certain points to kind of make you aware of your overall situation, but very, very rarely would he be directive. And I think that's very, very wise, because, you know, I always felt with him that, I mean, one of the main precepts, among the many precepts I received from him, when I look back through old correspondence and reflect on different kinds of communication, the overwhelming emphasis was the need for me to take personal responsibility for myself. My tendency is only too easily to defer, especially to a more experienced person or somebody with a stronger voice, or I want to please people. He, so many times, either in the way he acted or the things he said to me, it was always and all the time about taking individual responsibility. And I think probably that's, you know, that is a really big teaching, actually. Yeah. Does that help you?
Yes.
That? Yeah. Yeah. What is?
That kind of discernment between order member X saying this particular teaching and order member Y saying a different one, and being able to intuit for oneself what one needs at a particular time. Is that sort of something you can cultivate?
Well, yes, you should be cultivating it. It's kind of wisdom. It's in a kind of intelligence, isn't it? I don't know what to call it. Intuition, intelligence, discernment, discrimination, prudence, even, to use a very old-fashioned word. Very, very important to do that, to reflect on, does it make sense what they're saying? You know, does it hold together? You know, what anybody's saying or what I'm reading, does this make sense? Do I really know what this means? You know, and you're not that about. Does it resonate with my experience? If it's against my experience, that might be a good thing, because maybe my experience is limited, or it might not be a good thing. Okay, there's this particular recommendation to practice in this way. Sounds okay, let's try it out, and then we reflect on it. Also, of course, another thing you've got to bring in is things like, well, is this in accordance with the precepts? What they're suggesting. Does this relate to the path as I understand it, or as the Buddha's taught it? You see what I mean? So, but you in asking those questions, yes, I think you can cultivate that kind of discernment. Tremendously important to do that, I think. You develop right view, to use very old-fashioned Buddhist language. Yeah, yeah. Right attitude, yeah.
Do you think that with regard to what you were saying about effort, do you think that what the Buddha said about don't just accept, go by your own experience, do you think that's been misinterpreted?
Well, it can be misinterpreted, because the Buddha gives a very definite criteria of how you evaluate whether or not a practice works or not. I can't remember all the different things. A lot of emphasis on renunciation in that. So it is your experience, but it's definitely your experience of practicing the Dharma, not your just general experience of life, if you see what I mean. Yeah. Okay. Useful, clarifying precepts. Good. Shall we edge into the next precept, a longer one this time, from a teacher called The Final Goal of the Teaching. Ku, Guk and Drom asked a teacher, what is the final goal of the teaching? Really good question. Again, what is the final goal of the teaching, or what is the ultimate aim of the Dharma? Goal, I don't know again what the Tibetan is, but goal in Sanskrit is artha, which means goal, good, meaning. The Buddha uses it quite a lot, actually, to indicate enlightenment. So what is the ultimate meaning of the teaching? What is the ultimate goal of the teaching? What is the sort of the greatest good of the teaching? It's very important to know this. It's very important to know where you're going. Very important to know where you're going. Do you remember, another precept? This was from one of Bhante's Hindu teachers named Swami Ramdas, who Bhante stayed with in an ashram in I think somewhere in South India, as far as I can remember. And he and his friend, Satyapriya, who became Buddha Rakshita, so it was before Bhante had become a bhikshu, they asked Swami Ram Dass, why do so many people start on the spiritual life and so few end? And Swami Ram Dass replied, they have no idea, because they don't have a clear idea of where they're going, and because they don't have a clear idea of how to get there. So a very, very good little teaching to reflect on. We need to know where we're going. We need to know what the goal is. Of course, immediately what comes up, well, I can be very goal orientated. I can be over idealistic, and that creates problems for me because I become willful and all that. Well, yes, that's true. But that, I wouldn't say, is that, that doesn't mean that you reject the notion of a goal, of an aim, of an ultimate meaning. It means you've got to sort of change your relationship to it, not in terms of sort of grasping for something, but in terms, much more in terms of needing to contemplate what the ultimate aim of things is. This is tremendously important. There's a very good lecture by Bhante called Reflections on Going Forth, where he talks about what literalism is. He's a great critic. He often talks about the problem of literalism in Dharma life. And by literalism, he means you set up an idea of the goal, and then you try to grasp hold of that goal, try to incorporate it into yourself. This can happen sometimes in meditation. You have an idea about meditation. Maybe that idea has come because you've had some sort of meditative experience, or you've heard all about dhyanas and insight. So you have an idea of that in your mind, and you try to grab hold of it and incorporate it into yourself. That is self-defeating. It does not work. And it's the same with enlightenment itself. People have ideas of enlightenment. They try to grab hold of it, and then they create tensions and problems and all the rest of it. Much more what we need to do if we're to have a sense of the goal is to really understand it. Understand in depth and breadth and detail what the nature of the ultimate is, what the nature of enlightenment is, and then contemplate it reverentially. Contemplate it reverentially. Realize that this is a sublime ideal, a sublime goal that we have a feeling for, a response to. And when we contemplate it reverentially, then the energy comes to move in the direction of it. We'll also start to understand how we need to live and how we need to change in relation to that ultimate ideal. It's very, very important that this is alive. This is related, I think, very much to Shraddha, to faith. Such an important, much more than a mental state. Shraddha is, the way Shraddha is described, sort of remarkably in recent years, people are sort of dismissing Shraddha as something just to do with a sort of typology, or it's just mere devotion. When you look at the tradition, when you look at the analysis of Shraddha, it's quite obvious that Shraddha, faith, is the total response of our being to enlightenment. In Shraddha, there's a strong emotional response to the ideal, but there's also a strong cognitive or intellectual component and understanding, and a volitional response as well. Because you're beginning to realise that enlightenment is not a sort of part, it's not an idea. There's nothing partial about it. It's, if you like, for want of a better way of putting it, it's absolutely total. It's the life of life. And so your whole being responds to it. That's what Shraddha really is. So it's very, very important to have this in one's life. that sense, if you like, of that which transcends, of the ultimate goal. I couldn't live without it. I couldn't practice the Dharma without it. Every day, the main way I contemplate this is, I would say, in my meditation every day. The sequence of practices that I go through, and in particular the meditation on the Bodhisattva that I was given at the time of ordination. That's an extremely rich image, because it does bring all of me in response, because it's an image, and because image, the imagination is the total response of one's being to the image. That really sums up the sort of essence of enlightenment for me. And without that, my life wouldn't have a compass. My Dharma life would not have any kind of direction. My day would not have any kind of direction. So it's very, very important to have this sense of the goal, to have this sense of the ultimate nature of things, as a sort of horizon in your being, in your consciousness, as a way of orientating yourself. Is so important, you know, for us. This is the way we really become integrated, by the way. Integration in Buddhism isn't just a sort of psychotherapeutic exercise or anything like that. It's integrating around enlightenment, where the whole idea of a mandala is very, very useful. That a mandala is the reorganization of your life around the refuges, around going for refuge. So very, very important that we know the final goal of the teaching. So very good question from these three disciples. And a teacher, of course, could say any number of things about the final goal of the teaching, because the goal can be described in so many different ways, and sometimes people think that the Buddha didn't say anything at all about the goal, about nirvana. You know, it is true, it is beyond words, it's beyond saying. But there's a wonderful chapter in The Three Jewels by Bhante. Bhante, it is, you know, one of his, you know, classic Sangharakshita of a certain period. It's called The Goal. And he goes into I don't think it's exhaustive, but it's pretty good. He goes into all the different ways in which the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition have described the goal. Conceptually, symbolically, affectively in terms of emotion, cognitively, mythically, as a person, which he said is actually the supreme description, interestingly enough. Well worth reading that, because sometimes I think we hear the word nirvana or enlightenment or insight. There can be very, very narrow ways of conceiving of those things, and that really doesn't do justice to the tradition, and it won't do justice to us, because we've got to find the descriptions of the final goal of the teaching that really move us, that really makes us want to get up in the morning and practice, that really makes us want to work on ourselves and change ourselves. So if you sometimes think, well, I don't have a feeling for enlightenment, I don't understand enlightenment, maybe you just haven't looked deeply enough at what's on offer. You know, because you know, you have to remember that the tradition says things like nirvana is the satisfaction of all wishes. Nirvana is the satisfaction of all possible desires. It's an incredible thing to say. All your desires will be fulfilled in enlightenment and nirvana. So that means it's talking to all of us, talking to the deepest in us. So yes, have a real think about that. Again, maybe this is something you can talk about in your groups. What descriptions, explanations or evocations of enlightenment really move you, really make you want to practice, you know, really look into yourself, really look into your heart about that. Anyway, what a t-shirt says, the final goal of the teaching is possession of the essence of buoyantness and compassion. Just as in the world, there is a panacea for all sickness called the solitary heroic medicine, there is the realization of voidness which remedies all the fettering passions. So the final goal of the teaching is the possession, is possession of the essence of voidness and compassion. Don't trip up over the word possession. He doesn't mean it in a possessive sense. He's got to use some sort of language. You could say attainment or something like that if you'd prefer. But I rather like this idea that you are actually going to get something, personally, that you're going to find something. And he's evoking a sort of myth. Finding this, the solitary heroic medicine, another translation would be the single victorious cure, or the single victorious medicine. So presumably this is based on some ancient Indian myth that somewhere there is a wonderful kind of pot or vase which has within it the medicine that will cure all possible sicknesses. I'm sure there's a myth about this, that and it would bring off all sorts of, bring up all kinds of myths, stories of going on an epic journey, an epic search, you know, to find this wonderful potion. Drink this potion and all your illnesses are cured. All the illnesses of the world are cured. It's a bit like the whole idea of the nectar of immortality. Have this nectar and you never die. It's a similar sort of idea. So again, this touches on this mythic dimension for us, the myth of the voyage, the journey to find some wonderful potion, in this case, this wonderful medicine. It's a very, very deep myth in human consciousness the world over. And here he's saying, well, the medicine is going to be the possession of the essence of voidness and compassion. This is a translation of the Sanskrit, Shunyata Karuna Garbha. The word Garbha is one of those interesting words. It can mean womb, it can mean matrix, it can mean heart. It's often translated in Tibetan as Nyingpo. It can mean essence, and this is the way they've chosen to translate it. I find this just something very, very attractive. I almost have an image in my mind of some sort of gold sphere that you sort of find somewhere, and if you could bring that into your heart, all would be well. Everything would be fine. That's the sort of little kind of image that comes to my mind when I think of this for some reason. So this essence of voidness and compassion. So shunyata can be translated as voidness or emptiness. The truth that there is no substantial, fixed, unchanging element or essence in oneself and in all of the things around us and in other people. There's nothing fixed and unchanging. It doesn't mean that there's nothing. It doesn't mean that nothing exists. But there's no unchanging entity in anything. No sort of that you can sort of separate out. Very, very sort of mysterious word, emptiness. I think it evokes so much, actually. People have even translated it or interpreted it in some traditions as the mystery that life is the mystery, because you cannot identify any final element in anything, in anybody. And that doesn't mean that there's just a nihilistic vacuum. It means things become deeply, deeply mysterious, because all of your conceptions and labels and words and ideas about things just vanish in relation to that mystery, in relation to that voidness. So the essence of voidness and compassion as one essence. So this, it's not to be separated out from compassion, from love, from compassion for those who suffer. They can't be separated. Compassion here is sometimes described as the radiance of emptiness. This is the way this tradition will describe it. Emptiness isn't a sort of nothing. It radiates. Some traditions talk about emptiness as prabhashvara, as clear light, and that clear light is compassion. So when you wake up, when you realize the emptiness of everything, that is a waking up to the sort of radiance, if you like, of everything, and that turns into compassion, or that is compassion. Very, very important that we don't separate out emptiness from love and compassion. Tremendously important. And Atisha is saying they are one essence. When Bhante comments on this in the seminar, he says the essence of voidness is compassion, and the essence of compassion is voidness. If you go into voidness, you arrive at compassion. If you go into compassion, you arrive at voidness. So when we're looking at our practices, you know, when we're doing, say, the metta bhavana, if we really go into metta bhavana deeply and deeply and deeply, we will find the emptiness of all things. You know, you can even just sort of work that out as you meditate on metta, as your metta becomes less and less dependent on likes and dislikes, and more and more dependent, as it were, on itself, on just the free flowing of metta. That means that you're not setting up a self that out of attachment and aversion. You're overcoming that, or neutrality. That's vanishing. So therefore, there is some emptiness, because the metta is becoming more and more, well, it just doesn't care, as it were, what's before it, who's before it, not interested in that. There is just metta, because there is a living being there. So self, a substantial entity, has disappeared in that. And similarly, if you're doing a meditation on emptiness, and you don't really get to do these kinds of meditations until you're getting near to ordination, but when you do the six element practice, for example, where you're reflecting on non-ownership, that you don't own anything, you don't own yourself, the elements that make you up, earth, water, fire, air and space, are not really yours. What you find when you do that practice properly, and you're doing it on the basis of metta, that in the last stage of the practice, particularly with consciousness, you just feel this expansion. You just feel this expansion. Yes, there's a seeing through of self and other, and what results is this ease of awareness, which becomes loving. So the essence of emptiness is love and compassion. You can't separate these things out, and Atisha is making that very, very clear. And he particularly focuses, though, on voidness, because he says, just as in the world there is a panacea for all sickness called the solitary heroic medicine, there is the realization of voidness which remedies all the fettering passions. So fettering passions here is probably klesha, or defilement. Klesha is actually very much, it literally means affliction. So he's probably making a bit of a play on the medical analogy. Kleshas, like craving and hatred and anger and rage and jealousy and pride and conceit and delusion, the different kinds of delusion and so on, all the different kinds of kleshas, these are seen as an illness. They're seen as an afflictive illness. There's something that are literally poisoning your system, poisoning your consciousness, maybe even poison your body as well. I know that's an area that people tend to look at these days, scientists and so on. But it's the realization of voidness that's going to deal with these kleshas. Because if you see through any kind of fixed and separate sense of self, you've finally destroyed these kleshas. They don't obtain anymore. You see through them. But I don't think, when he says, but I think he's using voidness here as a sort of shorthand for voidness and compassion. He's not sort of going to separate them out. He's not saying that you can neglect love and compassion in that realization. We'll be coming to, I'll come to that a bit more later on. But then the three men ask a question again. But many say they have realized voidness. Why do their anger and attachment remain? Why do their hatred and craving remain? Anger, attachment, hatred and craving. Why is all that still going on? And yet they say they've realized emptiness, they've realized voidness. It could be that that question is reflecting the state of some aspects of Tibetan Buddhism at the time. We do know around that time that there were some, you know, some slightly odd Buddhist practitioners who, sort of particularly of the tantric variety, who would, you know, they'd have what has been called this crazy wisdom, where, you know, wrathful activity, you know, including the destruction of enemies and all, you know, all sorts of, you know, wacky sexual activity and all the rest of it, you know, and just the accumulation of possessions and so on, is sort of presented as skillful means, as wisdom and compassion. I wonder if that's what the three brothers are particularly concerned about, the rationalization of anger and attachment as wisdom. I don't know, I'm not sure. Maybe they've just come across, you know, just ordinary deluded people who claim an insight and yet they're still angry and attached. And Atisha's response is unequivocal. They are speaking empty words, vain words, hollow words. For when you fully realize the meaning of voidness, your body, speech and mind react with pleasure, like slipping fresh butter into barley soup. Like slipping fresh butter into barley soup. So he's being quite clear about this. Of course, people pick up on the fully realized bit and say, well, if you've partially realized, you can still have a bit of anger and attachment. But I think that's really missing the thrust of Atisha's concerns. Even if you've partially realized, if there is such a thing, you would be very deeply concerned about your anger and attachment issues. You know, you wouldn't rationalize them away. You'd feel embarrassed about them, ashamed of them. Your sense of hri, as it's called, of shame in relation to the truth, would be very, very strong if you'd realized some degree of emptiness. Tremendously important point. While we're on that, this quality of shame, of hri, very hard to translate or give a feeling for what hri really is. It's the sense of burning, actually, that arises when you see that you're doing something unskillful, or you've done something unskillful, or you're about to do something unskillful. Your sense of the ideal, your sense of faith, rises up very strongly, and you experience it as a sort of burning sensation. It's very uncomfortable, but very, very skillful. Quite different from irrational guilt, where you don't really know why you feel bad about yourself. It's just that somewhere along the line, you know that you're going to be punished by a god you no longer believe in, or your mum, or something like that, or all of them. Shame is very, very different. Shame is that sense of deep embarrassment and remorse that arises in relation to to what is unskillful. And it's even related, as I say, to the ideal, even related to sort of a sense of emptiness and compassion. Lama Govinda has written a brilliant piece on the significance of Hri, and he points out that the word Hri is the same as the seed syllable Hri in Amitabha's mantra, Om Amideva Hri. So it's the same word. So Amitabha is red. He is the Buddha of emptiness and compassion. So Lama Govinda's pointing out, when you experience shame, you know, when you in relation to something unskillful, it's actually the rising up of Amitabha within you. It's the rising up of emptiness and compassion in you. What have I done? Or how could I even contemplate doing this? So if you've even got some sense of emptiness or even some realization, it actually should be resulting in quite a lot of shame in relation to the kleshas. If it's the full realization, the kleshas won't be there. And as he says, you'll then experience enormous pleasure, great bliss. If you've really got a realization of the Dharma, to whatever degree, it's going to result in joy, in bliss, even. One of the hallmarks of Buddhist practice, you notice this when you read of any of the great masters, when they describe their realization. It's a tremendous sense of joy. Get very suspicious, I think, when people's account of their Dharma life is one misery after another. I know things can be tough in the Dharma life. I've certainly experienced that myself. But it's a bit odd if you say you're a Buddhist and there isn't a sense of joy in that. Because after all, you've found the cure to all sickness, to use the teacher's metaphor. You've found something that's incredibly liberating. Okay, things are tough, we know that, but there should be, really. Can't say should, can you? But you know what I mean. If there isn't that sort of sense of joy and wonder, of gratitude and thanksgiving, something isn't quite right. Notice this in the Bodhicharavatara, when Shantideva is... It's quite obvious something like the bodhicitta has arisen in him. He's just full of joy and full of gratitude and thanksgiving and wonder. This is incredible. He's also very aware, as the text goes on, of all the or everything he needs to work on. But there is this sort of sense of joy that comes from that sense of bliss and wonder. So maybe that is something too you can reflect upon. Are you allowing yourself to experience joy? Are you allowed? Because sometimes I think people are not sure that they're allowed to experience those things, and happiness, and you know, those very sort of basic things that go with some sort of opening up to the Dharma. Well, Atisha is very, very clear that. Your body, speech and mind are going to react with pleasure when you've realised voidness. And he uses the analogy of, it's like slipping fresh butter into barley soup. Again, a soup analogy. And I think, you know, it's sort of, you know, they'd all know how pleasurable that is to see the butter going into the barley soup. And they also will know what good barley soup taste like when the butter's been, you know, slipped into the barley. Another image he uses, it's like you'll become like cotton that has been softened. Cotton is quite hard apparently, but when it's carded, when it's trampled upon, it becomes very, very soft. I like this sort of imagery of softening, that with the realization of voidness, there's the softening of your being, the softening of your consciousness. You soften, and in that, and you expand, and that is enormously pleasurable. The more you soften and expand, the more you open up. It's a tremendous feeling of happiness that goes with that. I think it's almost axiomatic that happiness seems to come when you're not tight. You know, when you're not tight and fixated with yourself and your kleshas and all your anxieties and worries, when you can sort of breathe out and really open up, there's a real happiness and pleasure in that. That's why I find the Metta Bhavana such a fantastic practice, not just as a meditation, but, you know, trying to sort of live it out as well, and sort of, you know, going beyond, you know, really making the effort to go beyond my sort of sense of separation. There is always a happiness in that, because there's a positive self-forgetting, there is such a thing as a positive self-forgetting. We're far too obsessed with ourselves, I think. So really think about that. It also reminds me a bit, this business of butter and softening. There's a great Maharashtrian poet named Tukaram from the 16th, 17th century, one of the great bhakti poets of India. And he has a wonderful poem where he's describing what a real sant or saint is, somebody who's realised the truth, a sant. In the Indian context, he talks about he who identifies with the battered and beaten know that he is a real saint, a man who's really fully realised the truth. And he says such a man is soft on the outside, soft on the inside, he's just like butter. Very, very homely sort of image for what you know, what a true man really is, a man of truth really is. And I think this is what Arya Deva's, Atisha's really trying to get at here. When you realise something, it's going to become pleasurable. That will turn into love and compassion. That will turn into that. But also you can go the other way. If you work on love and compassion, it will help you to realise that as well. And then he quotes Arya Deva. The great sage Arya Deva said, "The nature of existence, is it empty or not?" Not empty or night. "The nature of existence, is it empty or not? Merely feeling this doubt tears samsara asunder." Very, very famous phrase. Arya Deva was in the Madhyamika tradition, following Nagarjuna. Some generations after Nagarjuna, wrote a very famous text on Shunyata called the 400 Verses, which is very well studied. And he's talking about the level of the student in terms of emptiness practice. And in this, it's very interesting what he's saying, that if you're teaching emptiness, if you're teaching the empty nature of things to a student, you must do it very, very sparingly. They mustn't be given too much, just a homeopathic dose, because if they're given too much, it will destroy their practice. It's just enough that they have a doubt about the nature of life. Is it empty or not? Let's not just assume that it's empty. Maybe it's not empty, but question your existence. Question your experience. So if that's what happens, and the effect of that is to rip up samsara, to rip up conditioned existence, well, if that's the case, with just a doubt, where you're just questioning, is it empty or not, what about with the full realization? Very, very famous phrase from Arya Deva. Yeah, I think this is again very, very important, this sense of sort of questioning. And maybe it's worth, again, I said yesterday how important it is to go back to your initial response to coming along to the Dharma. What brought you along? And I'm sure for all of you, in one way or another, was a tremendous sense of questioning that started to develop in you, that what you were being given by life, by your family, by, you know, your work, your career, your studies, by the media, you know, just what's on offer, just isn't cutting it. It's not enough. It's not speaking to something deep in me. Well, that's beginning to question. You don't have to be metaphysical with emptiness about that. You started to question, and that resulted in you changing. In you changing the way you're going to live. That's the beginning of tearing up samsara. Arya Deva's verse is very dramatic, as if you just have that question and then suddenly samsara is ripped apart. I don't think it needs to be like that. It could be a gradual process, you know, where you're questioning about yourself, your life, your relationships with other people, starts to shake things up, starts to tear at the fabric of things. Well, go back to that. Go back to that initial impetus that brought you along. And yes, build on that through your practice. Therefore, when you realise the correct meaning of voidness, it is just like the solitary heroic medicine. For all the path is included in that realisation. So I think we'll stop there, and because we're coming on to the path being included in the realisation of the voidness, and that means going into the paramita. So we'll stop there for today, and we'll look at things tomorrow. So look at other texts tomorrow. I think what I'm going to do, though, is end with a poem for you. One of the wonderful things about studying with Bhante, with Sangharakshita, one of the reasons why I love him so much as a teacher and why I'm so grateful to him as a teacher is that you don't just get the Dharma, you don't just get the Pali Canon, you don't just get the Mahayana, you don't just get the Tibetans and the Tantra and references to Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. You don't just get the wonderful application to our experience now. You get culture as well. I'm so grateful to Bhante because in so many teachings he refers to the great poets, the great artists, the great musicians. And in relation to this quote from Arya Deva, so Arya Deva is what, from the 4th century? Bhante just said in the seminar, oh, it is rather reminiscent of Walt Whitman's of the terrible doubt of appearances. Walt Whitman, 19th century, great American poet. So, of course, I had to go off and find of the terrible doubt of appearances. It's very interesting, this poem. It's very rather mysterious poem. But it ends up talking about friendship. So I'm going to just read this as a little treat. Because, well, I'm going to follow my teacher and have a cultural reference in the exposition. This is from Leaves of Grass, of the terrible doubt of appearances, of the terrible doubt of appearances, of the uncertainty after all that we may be deluded, that maybe reliance and hope are but speculations after all. That maybe identity beyond the grave is a beautiful fable only. Maybe the things I perceive, the animals, plants, men, hills, shining and flowing waters, the skies of day and night, colours, densities, forms, maybe these are, as doubtless they are, only apparitions. And the real something has yet to be known. How often they dart out of themselves as if to confound me and mock me. How often I think neither I know nor any man knows aught of them. Maybe seeming to me what they are, as doubtless as they indeed but seem, as from my present point of view, and might prove, as of course they would, nought of what they appear, or nought anyhow from entirely changed points of view. To me, these and the like of these are curiously answered by my lovers, my dear friends, when he whom I love travels with me or sits a long while holding me by the hand, when the subtle air, the impalpable, the sense that words and reason hold not, surround us and pervade us, then I am charged with untold and untellable wisdom. I am silent. I require nothing further. I cannot answer the question of appearances or that of identity beyond the grave, but I walk or sit indifferent. I am satisfied. He should, of my hand, has completely satisfied me. Good, thanks.